dislike the thought of your address, phone number, and your family's information being sold online? Imagine having your own private detective who scours the internet for data brokers selling your personal info. When they find it in the wrong hands, they help you take it back. McAfee Plus is just like that, a private detective helping you take control of your data and privacy. Get all-in-one protection with McAfee Plus and learn how to protect your everything at McAfee.com/podcast.
Every day, we rise, challenging ourselves to work for what we believe in. At U.S. Border Patrol, protecting our borders is more than a job. It's a calling. Agents answer the call, working together to keep our country and communities safe. If you're ready for a new mission, join U.S. Border Patrol and go beyond. Learn more at cbp.gov/careers.
Robert Black is an author who has written a 6-book series about 7 influential mathematicians, their lives, and their work. To talk about his latest books and the series itself, we have Robert Black on today. All this and more on this episode of Breaking Math, episode 72, The Lifestyles of the Mathematical and Famous, an interview with Robert Black. I'm Sophia, and this is Breaking Math. With me, I have on Robert Black. Welcome.
Oh, thank you. I'm very glad to be here.
All right. So I guess I'm going to start by asking why you wrote this series. Who's your audience? What do you hope for people to get out of this series?
Well, my publisher is Royal Fireworks Press, which is a small press in New York, about an hour and a half outside the city. We market a lot to gifted children programs, homeschool programs, that sort of thing. And I've been working for the past 10 years, actually, or more, on using storytelling to communicate math concepts. I kind of have both in my background. I've been writing for 35-ish years, and I'm an engineer, and my parents are math teachers, and still keeping up with it even now that they're retired and in their 80s. My dad does FaceTime tutoring sessions with one of my nieces, and my mom just took a new tutoring gig to help somebody with geometry. So it goes with me. I started looking for ways to use storytelling to teach math, because math does not have the best reputation in education circles, and especially in this country. If you watch TV, you know, math is always something that kind of the nerd character does off to the side. So I got the idea that, you know, we can use storytelling to show that math is something that real people do for real reasons to solve real problems. And so, of course, my first attempt to do this was a fantasy series about a girl who sees monsters and ghosts and werewolves. And it turns out that they're all bad at math, that people are afraid of monsters, but monsters are afraid of math. And this girl, my main character, can do math. And so they all come to her for help with their math problems.
Yeah, that's really interesting. And just the whole storytelling aspect. I mean, I've often said on this podcast that, you know, if you're struggling to read a concept, to understand a concept, read the motivation for it, because there's often a story there, you know, a struggle. Right. And I think it's great that your work focuses on that. And it strikes me too that your mission is very similar to Breaking Math's mission, which is to take mathematics, which is taught as a famous paper can't remember said, like if you had paint by numbers instead of finger painting in kindergarten, people might grow up to hate painting and art. So it's just one of those things that is really cool to people who often weren't, traumatized with math. And, you know, it's seen often as a traumatic experience, even for teachers who have to teach math to their like elementary school students and things
absolutely,
like that.
Absolutely. And something that came to me just in the past couple of weeks, you know, they've had this kerfuffle in Florida over banning math textbooks. And once they started to release some of the math textbooks that were supposed to be objectionable, you know, what a lot of them had is this thing called social emotional learning. And I didn't know what that was. And I still don't know what that is beyond, you know, 30 seconds of reading Wikipedia, which contrary to some ideas, some people thinking is, it does not make you an expert, but just the fact that they see a need to include teaching empathy and feelings with math gives you the idea that, that most people have the assumption that math isn't a feeling thing, that math isn't a human thing. And so when I started looking into that over the past couple of weeks, it's just like, well, this is what I've been trying to communicate for, you know, 10 years is that, that yes, math is a feeling thing and math is a thing that, that human beings do. And so now to, we've gone way off track from your original question, but now I'm going to circle back to it. You know, the idea of the biographies is that here are some real people in history who made some major breakthroughs in mathematics for all sorts of human reasons, for all sorts of, you know, reasons that people can relate to. I mean, you know, the very first book, Blaise Pascal, pretty much came up with probability theory because somebody asked him for gambling advice. So, you know,
one of my favorite things about math history.
Yes, absolutely. So that's the point of the books. And my publisher actually suggested doing the biographies, but then they left it up to me to choose who my subjects are. So it was a very good collaboration, and I think we've come out with a really good result.
Oh yeah, definitely. I mean, just looking, at the birth dates and death dates of the mathematicians involved, we'll kind of go over each book quickly and the mathematicians within. But it spans about four centuries. Just these mathematicians. So, I mean, four centuries in mathematical terms. You know, you covered this in quite a bit of detail because I mean, that's really only about five lifetimes. So you've written six books so far, correct?
Right.
And are you planning to write more?
Yeah. Interesting you mentioned four centuries because four centuries is pretty much about as far back as you can go and get a lot of good, reliable detail about individual people's lives. I mean, my publisher wanted something on Euclid, and this is, people don't know what Euclid did in his daily life back in Alexandria. So, but the biography series is complete, and I am moving on to a new project. But the new project does involve history and mathematics and individuals in history, and it goes back even farther than four centuries. In fact, considerably farther than four centuries, and that's all I'm prepared to say about it at the moment.
Awesome, awesome. So without further ado, let's jump in.
Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, no, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details. With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting.
No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
All right, so your first book, Pascal and Fermat, The Probability Pen Pals, was written about 3 years ago, 2019. So tell us about Blaise Pascal and Pierre de Fermat.
Pascal was a mathematician, son of a mathematician. Blaise Pascal was the son of a French natural philosopher, is what they called it. Pascal's father, Étienne, was part of Marie Mersenne's salon in Paris. Mersenne corresponded with, again, natural philosophers, mathematicians, scientists all over Europe.
And you're saying, and just to clarify, you're saying natural philosopher was the umbrella term for mathematicians and scientists.
They were not the first person to be called a scientist. Actually, shows up in one of my books. Her name was Mary Somerville, and that was in Victorian England. But before Mary Somerville, they were called natural philosophers. Yes. One thing about Blaise Pascal is he was kind of a child prodigy. He was interested in everything and dove into everything passionately when he discovered it. And his father actually forbade him to study Euclid at first because he knew that once Blaise Pascal got a hold of Euclid, you know, there would be no stopping him. And so Blaise actually studied Euclid in secret. because, you know, of course, once your father tells you not to do something, that's exactly what you want to do. So
I'm just imagining him under the covers with the candle.
Well, we would hope not a candle, but you know, he took.
Oh yeah, right.
You know, he took sticks from the fire and used the charcoal on the end of them to draw geometric figures and things. Pascal later, when his father got involved in some tax collecting work and the workload was so difficult, you know, all this was done by hand. And so Blaise invented a mechanical calculating machine, one of the very first. And it was this thing with cranks and gears and stuff. And you had to know some complicated mathematics to interpret what the machine was telling you. But he invented this mechanical calculating machine. So by the time he was in his 30s, he had this friend who was a writer. His friend went by the pen name, the Chevalier Dumaire. And
what does that mean in French? Do you know?
Chevalier is like a knight, and and maire, which I'm probably pronouncing wrong, is where he was from. But he was kind of an expert on all things fashionable in France. And one of the fashionable things was gambling. And so he asked Pascal this question called the problem of the points. Which is, suppose you have two men playing a gambling game where they have to accumulate a certain number of points to win the prize money, and the game has to stop before either side has gotten to the required number of points. What is the fair way to distribute the money? This question had been around for a couple of centuries. Nobody had solved it. And Pascal dove into it, and he didn't quite know how to do it, because we were talking about predicting the future, and that was something that, you know, you're not supposed to be able to do. And so he ended up, Marie Mersenne put him in touch with another Frenchman named Pierre de Fermat. Fermat is kind of the greatest of all time, the GOAT of amateur mathematicians. He was not a natural philosopher. He was a lawyer. He was a government official in his local government, and he did math as his hobby. And he wrote letters to people all over Europe with all his mathematical ideas, and he'd pose problems. And Fermat's most famous problem, called Fermat's Last Theorem, was not proved until 1994. So he knew what he was doing, and he knew how to challenge people with some pretty advanced stuff. And so Pascal and Fermat never met in real life, never met in person, but they wrote letters to each other over several months, and together they came up with what we know as probability theory today.
So let me ask really quickly, because you see this a lot in this time period where mathematicians, scientists, whatever, will be sending letters to one another. Do you happen to know how they got hold of each other's addresses and things like that? How do they know about, you said they got put in touch with one another. Was it really just that simple, addresses?
There were various people who, people who knew people. And one of them was this man I've mentioned a couple times, Marie Mersenne. He was.
And is this the Mersenne of the Mersenne Primes?
That's the guy, the very same. And he ran a salon in Paris that eventually became something that his name escapes me right now, the Academy of Paris, you know, a very respected school came out of Mersenne's salons. And it was just people who knew people, and the postal system, you know, was pretty rudimentary at the time. But you had these people like Mersenne who were kind of the focal point, and they sent letters to other people all over Europe.
Interesting. And you've mentioned the salons, which were essentially, from what my understanding, social clubs with admission fees.
Right. And they got together and they talked about the latest scientific or mathematical studies they'd been working on.
When I just wanted to bring that up also, I mean, because the term's been mentioned a few times, but also because one thing that we've talked about on the show before, kind of a difficult aspect of mathematics up to probably like the 1800s and even today in many respects, is something that is done by people who a lot of times are economically privileged. Mm-hmm. So I just wonder if you would like to speak anything to that in your research.
It is something that I have noticed. Pascal was privileged. Fermat was a lawyer. There are two women in the series, Florence Nightingale and Ada Lovelace, and they were both definitely privileged. But then again, on the other hand, some of my subjects were not. Benoit Mandelbrot was he was from a Jewish family, a Polish Jewish family. And spent World War II on the run from Nazis as a teenager in Vichy, France, had a completely, you know, disorganized, irregular education all the way up until he got into the Grande Écoles. The French system is different. You know, you have high school, but then you have university, and in between there's the Grande École, the big schools. And he got into not one, but the two most prestigious, and he chose the Polytechnic Institute. But before then, you know, he was a refugee, he was poor, his family had no money, his education was sporadic, and a lot of times he had a set of old encyclopedias that his father had managed to scrounge up because someone had thrown them out. So, you know, Mandelbrot started out very, very disadvantaged. Another example, David Blackwell was the son of a railroad worker. David Blackwell's father never made it past the fourth grade. And Blackwell also was African American at a time when, this was in the 20s, 30s, and 40s, when opportunities for
some of the worst time.
Yeah, not very good times. He was fortunate enough to have a geometry teacher in high school who saw his potential and started encouraging him in that direction. But even then, in the 1940s, he was fortunate enough to have a professor, his PhD advisor, was asked to join the Institute for Advanced Study at Princeton. And this professor was allowed to bring, you know, three of his recent PhDs along with him. And so Blackwell got to go to Princeton. Princeton didn't want him because visiting scholars at the Institute for Advanced Study are named as honorary members of the Princeton faculty, and Princeton did not want a black man on their faculty. And the people at the Institute for Advanced Study actually got together and threatened to disassociate themselves with Princeton if Blackwell was not given the same honors that the rest of the visiting scholars were given. After that, he was interviewed for a job at the University of California, which is where he ended up, but not for another 10 years. The guy that would have been his boss and eventually became his boss wanted to hire him. The upper manage, you know, his boss's boss, you know, the deans and everything, they were ready to hire him. The head of the department's wife objected because as the department head, they have all the new professors over for dinner, and her objection—
It was racist times.
Yes. Can I say, I'm not going to use the N word, but I'm going to use the D word, and you can bleep me. Her quote is reported to have been, I'm not going to have any darkies in my house. And so because...
Yeah, which is definitely a rough quote.
Yes. And so because the dean's wife objected to having a black man in her house, he did not get the job at UC. He ended up at UC 10 years later, but that was after 10 years. And you know, he was always very matter of fact about the racism that he had to contend with. I mean, he had always assumed that he wasn't going to be hired by UC Berkeley. And so he was busy applying to the historically black colleges, which he did get hired by one. There's another story about Blackwell is the first time he was in New Orleans and got on a bus there and saw the little signs that say, you know, coloreds stay here and whites only up here. And he thought that was so fascinating that when he got off the bus, he took one of the signs with him. So I don't know where it ended up, but he just kind of kept on doing his math. And in the 60s, he was at UC Berkeley and he was the first black professor there to receive full tenure. And the black students there made him their faculty advisor for the Black Student Union until they realized that he was more interested in doing math than in participating in the social activism of the 60s. And so they got rid of him and went with somebody else. You know, that was just his attitude is, hey, I've got this math to work on. So that's my thing.
Very Archimedes vibe of don't touch my circles.
Right.
So, yeah, we've talked about Pascal. We talked about Blackwell and we talked a little bit about Mandelbrot, but what we haven't done yet first we're going to talk about Florence Nightingale, Ada Lovelace, and then Edward Laurens. So tell us about Florence Nightingale. Who was she? What was her deal?
Florence Nightingale is known as basically the inventor of the modern nursing profession. Before Florence Nightingale, nurses were basically considered not much better than, you know, maids, house servants. Charles Dickens wrote a book in which he had a nurse in there who was an alcoholic, and a lot of them were alcoholics actually, because they were put on duty, you know, to watch the patients overnight in this grungy, dirty hospital, and a lot of them took to drinking just to get through it. Florence Nightingale. Yeah,
I will say that I have heard that that substance abuse continues to be a major problem for healthcare providers, but I think different stressors now.
Different stressors now. Florence Nightingale developed a passion, wanted to be a nurse very early on. Her family objected to it because it wasn't proper for a woman of her social standing to take on this low menial job. But she had learned through reading and then got to experience some of the professional nurses in Europe. And that was really the first place she saw that it could be a serious profession that required education, training, experience, that sort of thing. She was also very passionate about mathematics, something else that her family thought was inappropriate for a woman of her social standing to be interested in. She had to study it, and not in secret, but she studied it together with her aunt. They got up at like 5 a.m. before the servants were up and studied math together for an hour in the morning. What she's remembered for is during the Crimean War, healthcare was... for the wounded and sick soldiers was terrible. The British Army was actually losing more soldiers to disease than to battlefield injuries. This was not new. This had happened in all the wars previous. But what was different about Crimea is that Crimea had journalists who had telegraphs. And so not exactly CNN, but still, this was a revolution in that the British people could read in the newspapers every day that, hey, all our soldiers are dying from disease, from cholera. And so there was this huge outcry to clean up the hospitals. And Florence Nightingale, because of who she knew, was appointed the head of a corps of nurses to go over to Crimea. Actually, she didn't go to... she went to Crimea eventually, but the hospital was in Scutari, which is in Turkey. Today, the town is called Üsküdar, and that's where the primary hospital was. I can't wait to talk to school kids. I haven't been able to talk to school kids because of COVID, but I'm looking forward to the time that I'll get to talk to school kids and try to gross them out with all the things that were going on at the hospital in Scutari before Florence Nightingale got there. And
why don't you gross out our audience with one story?
Well, the toilets in the hospital were all backed up. And so they got these big tubs and put the big tubs in the middle of the room. And that's what all the soldiers used right there. And the orderlies didn't want to empty them because they smelled bad. And eventually they would empty them because Florence would go around and stand there glowering at them until they emptied the tubs of all the, you know, what they'd been used for. When they finally flushed out the sewer system to get the sewer system working again, they found dead horses rotting in the sewage lines and things. And basically the entire hospital was sitting on top of a gigantic cesspit. And so, you know, it's very hard to have people get well under those conditions.
Oh, definitely. Also, did somebody flush a horse down the toilet?
No, I don't know how it got there, but there was a dead horse in the sewage line. Somehow it had gotten there. I'm not sure how it did.
And 1 second, I need to let my dogs in, but then okay. I'll continue.
Hey guys, it is Ryan. I'm not sure if you know this about me, but I'm a bit of a fun fanatic when I can. I like to work, but I like fun too. It's a thing. And now the truth is out there. I can tell you about my favorite place to have fun. Chumba Casino. They have hundreds of social casino style games to choose from with new games released each week. You can play for free anytime, anywhere. And each day brings a new chance to collect daily bonuses. So join me in the fun. Sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
You know, Florence Nightingale, she's known as the lady with the lamp because at night she would get out her lamp and she would tour the hospital ward, which she wasn't supposed to do because it was considered inappropriate for ladies to be on the hospital wards after dark. But she went anyway, and she spent the whole night sitting with the soldiers, talking to them, or if they were dying, she would sit with them. And this was what she became known for, and she's known as the lady with the lamp. And in popular culture, that's where her story ends. Right there in Crimea, like she died there herself or something. But that's not the case. She lived another 54 years after Crimea. She lived more than half her life. In that second half of her life, the one that people don't know about, she was a pioneer in statistics. She went back to England, and she wanted to improve the sanitation of the hospitals. You know, she wanted to make her case to the public that, hey, this is something we need to do. Our soldiers are dying over there and they don't have to. Like I said, she was a very passionate statistician, but at the time, statistics were pretty much only found in these things called blue books, which were these big blue colored tomes that basically collected dust in government storerooms. And that was it. She wanted to communicate with numbers what the British Army was experiencing and what could be gained by making improvements. And so she took her statistics to the general public. And the way she did that was she used diagrams, some of which she invented herself. And so today, you know, we've just come through a pandemic still going on. But, you know, in the early days of the pandemic, they talked about flattening the curve and what are the numbers like and are they going up or are they going down? And, you know, any use of that, not just in medicine, but anywhere, any use of diagrams or graphs or anything, you pretty much have Florence Nightingale to thank for that. And people don't know that. People imagine her, you know, she's still marching around Scutari with her lamp. But no, she did much more after that.
That's fascinating. And you know what I'm noticing is a recurring theme amongst all of these is a certain degree of stubbornness.
Yes.
Well, I also think it's kind of sometimes necessary to make advancements, you know, to have a certain degree of stubbornness because you have to think, you know, what we have isn't enough. We have to add to it. And I'm also noticing that access to information, especially sometimes through technology, like, you know, books getting cheaper, like you said, the blue books that, you know, were that were gathering dust, but like, you know, nevertheless were probably a lot more accessible than, you know, records back thousands of years earlier. And then even to the modern day with like, you know, Mandelbrot and Blackwell and public education, it seems like access to information is really what creates mathematics.
Right. Well, it certainly helps. You have to have some place to start. And then you build upon that. That's another thing I wanted to point out is that math is collaborative. Math is cumulative. You know, Florence Nightingale did not do all this by herself. She had people she looked up to. There was a Belgian mathematician named Adolphe Quetelet that she idolized. She got help from a statistician in England who named William Farr, who had made one of the initial breakthroughs in. He was the one that basically statistically discovered that cholera is connected to water. Now, he was wrong about what that connection was, but the fact that he had made that connection to water enabled another person, John Snow, to figure out, well, maybe it's something in the water. And so that kind of communication and collaboration is essential for math, and it still is today.
Oh yeah, definitely. And then you even have other influences, right? Like the people who went around collecting the statistics of, in the case of Florence Nightingale, you know, just the blue books and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. But not only that, the social clubs set up obviously in France. So yeah, right. And it's much like, I mean, you didn't talk about the guy who made the steam engine, whose name escapes me, but you know, even him, he needed
James Watt
to design. Yeah, he needed people to, you know, solder the metal, mm-hmm. and you know, help construct the steam engine. So and now that's used as a part of this like the math and science that came out of that are used a lot in modern thermodynamics, obviously.
Right.
So yeah,
right.
I just wanted to agree with you.
Mm-hmm. Okay, round two. Name something that's not boring.
A laundry? Ooh, a book club. Computer solitaire, huh?
Ah, oh, sorry. We were looking for Chumba Casino. That's right. Chumbacasino.com has over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Wings are here.
Oh, from?
No, I'd never order from anymore. Popeyes now has wings in 5 flavors. Ghost pepper, roasted garlic parmesan, sweet and spicy, signature hot, and honey barbecue. Marinated in Louisiana spices, hand-battered and flipped. Makes no sense they're $5.99 for 6 pieces. Taste them.
Mmm, crunchy outside.
And juicy inside.
Consider me a convert.
That's the most romantic thing you've said to me all month.
We don't make sense. We make chicken.
Love that chicken from Popeyes.
Price may vary.
But I'm cool. So now we have Ada Lovelace. Who's Ada Lovelace?
Ada Lovelace was a celebrity child of a celebrity. She was the daughter, the only legitimate child of Lord Byron. Lord Byron was a poet and was known as much for his bad behavior as he was for his poetry. Lord Byron and Ada never met her father, because when she was only a month old, their parents split up. They never divorced, because that would have been too scandalous. And there was already enough scandal going around. Lord Byron had been caught up in a scandal involving his half-sister. And that kind of opened the floodgates, because other of Lord Byron's former lovers came out with stories of who he was, and including the woman who had given him the label Mad, Bad, and Dangerous to Know. And plus, Lord Byron was also in debt. So he basically got run out of the country when Ada was only a month or two old. He went off to Europe and eventually died in the Greek War of Independence from the Ottoman Empire. He didn't die in battle. He died of disease. So here we go back to more people in war die of disease than of battle wounds. So Ada never met him, but she idolized him, and she had some of his wildness about her. And her mother, Lady Byron, was very much afraid that Ada would go off and do all these crazy things. And kind of like the way children of celebrities are today. You know, you have Miley Cyrus and Billy Ray Cyrus, or you have, you know, Willow and Jaden Smith, who are the children of Will Smith and Jada Pinkett Smith. You have the child celebrities of this machine would take a problem of computing Bernoulli numbers. And I'm not going to get into what those are right now, but it basically takes the problem of calculating Bernoulli numbers and breaks it down into a series of steps that the analytical engine would be able to perform. And that is what she's known for. The other thing that I think is more important is she pointed out what computers could and couldn't do. She wrote, you know, people call the analytical engine a thinking machine, but it doesn't think at all. It only does what we tell it to do. It doesn't come up with any of this by itself. 100 years later, Alan Turing called this Lady Lovelace's objection. And today, a lot of people think that Lady Lovelace's objection is actually a more important hurdle for artificial intelligence to get over than the so-called Turing test. So, yeah, and so Turing came up with the name for the hurdle that's even higher than the Turing test. It's this thing that Ada Lovelace has pointed out and in my opinion, still hasn't been overcome. I mean, you know, IBM can put the Watson computer on Jeopardy and it can beat the biggest Jeopardy champions ever, but that's only because someone told it to do that. You know, Watson didn't think for itself, hey, I think I'll go on Jeopardy and I'll win the money. And, you know, it didn't think that. It did what it was told to do, and that's it.
Right. And also, like, where does artificial intelligence end is another question. Like, right. Not necessarily end, but like, you know, like, are we going to, like, what if we made, like, you know, a machine with an addictive personality? What are the ethics of that? How about like an angry machine or a jerk, you know? Mm-hmm. Like, and not only that, there's so many aspects of thought itself, which are sort of specific to the way that human beings, like, you know, like as evolved, like, you know, from apes kind of thing. Well, as another form of ape kind of thing, like, you know, have like very specific. I can't think of many. Well, okay, one example is like, you know, you see children when they first start learning and they, you know, have to like look at their look at their hands to learn that they open and close, what their hands look like, right. Things like that. And that ultimately contributes to probably a great extent the ways in which we derive inspiration and things like that. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I just wanted to say, and also there's the issue of, like, you know, the first machine to pass the Turing test might not always pass it, right? Mm-hmm. Because we might learn, like, you know, certain patterns. But all this to say, yeah, I do think that's a great point to bring up. Mm-hmm. And Ada Lovelace, she was 1800s,
yes.
Right? And I believe we said that Florence Nightingale was 1800s, but if we yes. hadn't, yeah. And
they actually knew each other in passing.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, they did. Not really, really well, but because Ada Lovelace died very young. She was in her 30s and she had cancer. And Florence Nightingale was still in her 20s at the time. So they didn't know each other well, but they, you know, they went through the same social circles.
Interesting. Yeah, you never know who knows each other in mathematical history sometimes. Mm-hmm. And then you got Edward Lorenz and the Chaotic Butterflies. Right. You talk about Edward Lorenz.
Edward Lorenz was an MIT professor. He was a mathematician at first, and then then World War II happened. Lorenz learned meteorology in order to be a weather forecaster in World War II, was sent out to the Pacific to work for 21st Bomber Command under Curtis LeMay. And the big thing at that time was they had the new B-29 bomber, which could go higher up than any other military plane ever had before. And so high up that they ran into the jet stream. And the first, you know, one of the first planes to hit the jet stream was kind of like, you know, they suddenly found themselves over the Aleutian Islands instead of Japan. Brought this information back, and Lorenz was part of the team that started to figure out the meteorology of how this worked and how they could use it to to make more effective airstrikes during the war. And Curtis LeMay came up with some pretty horrendous ideas, and I'm not going to get into that. But Lorenz learned weather forecasting because of World War II, came back and changed his field to meteorology. And by the late 1950s, he was very much in the camp of doing numerical weather forecasting. There was this idea that if you just had the right equations, you could calculate, you could predict the weather in advance. And in fact, there was a Walt Disney little 15-minute documentary that Walt Disney put together at some point in the late 1950s that envisioned this World Weather Bureau with satellites in orbit, and the World Weather Bureau would be able to collect so much information and compute it using the new electronic computers that we could forecast the weather, you know, weeks and months in advance, and so far in advance that we could do things to change the weather and control the weather. This was kind of a dream people had for several decades previously, and Lorenz was one of the people that was exploring this idea. By 1960, Lorenz had something that most other college professors or researchers of any kind didn't have yet, and that is he had his own computer. MIT had bought him a desk computer. And when I say a desk computer, it's not what you think today, that it goes on top of your desk. A desk computer was the size of a desk. is this big, gigantic thing. Lorenz described it as sounding like a small airplane flying overhead. The desk computer had its own office. They put it in Lorenz's office, but he didn't want to be in there with it because it was so noisy. So he moved down the hall and took an extra desk in the room where his assistants were, and the desk computer got its own room, and it did calculations for him. And interestingly, here's another example of who knows who. His very first programming assistant was a young woman who had just graduated college in mathematics and had moved to Boston because her husband was going to Harvard Law School. Her name was Margaret Hamilton. Working for Lorenz taught her a love of computer programming. And so she was originally thinking of getting a higher degree in mathematics, but she ended up going into computer programming instead, and ended up being the lead software engineer for NASA's Apollo moon program. And there's a famous picture of her in her, you know, very 1960s, 1970 looking outfit, standing next to a stack of binders that's as tall as she is. And that's the source code for the Apollo lunar module, or the Apollo guidance computer. That's Margaret Hamilton. She got her start doing weather prediction, weather forecasting software for Ed Lorenz. But I digress. So one day Lorenz is getting ready for a conference where he's going to present some of his ideas. And he's looking at a computer run of some weather forecasting predictions, you know, a weather simulation. And he decides he wants to rerun the calculation from somewhere in the middle so he can recheck his figures. So he looks at the line of numbers, you know, it's like, oh, okay, I'll pick this point right here. And he types in the numbers and he tells the computer, start at this point. And then he goes and he gets a cup of coffee. An hour later, he comes back and the computer is printing out a completely different pattern of results from the one it did before. And it being the early 1960s, the first assumption is that there's something wrong with the computer. But he looked into it more and he realized very quickly that it's not a computer problem. What had happened was the computer's memory kept the numbers to 6 decimal places, but it had only printed them out to 3. So when he went back and typed in the results from halfway through and said, here, start here, he wasn't giving the computer exactly the right numbers. One example is, the computer had known that a number was 0.506127, but it only printed 0.506. And so that's what he typed in, 0.506.
And a common assumption at the time would have been that, you know, like that it's numerical work. So, you know, it's very close, but, you know, because it's it was a differential equation.
Right. The differences will smooth out was the assumption, but they don't. They don't smooth out. They magnify and they get bigger. And that little difference was enough to throw the whole calculation off. And what Lorenz realized is what that means is that we will never have weather instruments that are precise enough to predict the weather beyond about 2 weeks. So all this stuff about predicting the weather months and months in advance is never going to happen, because we will never have instruments that are precise enough, because a slight difference smaller than what the instrument can measure, you know, say your thermometer goes to 0.001 of a degree, there's an error difference of, you know, 0.0001, that's enough to throw the whole thing off. The difference will magnify and propagate through the system. And so eventually, about 2 weeks later, you will have something completely different from what you had predicted.
Yeah, and I understand that when he gave his talk, there was a lot of excitement about, well, this means that we can control the weather by using peaceful explosions and this and that for manipulating the atmosphere. But they ignore the second part of the paper, right, that kind of talks about that you can't affect long-term statistical behavior.
Right. You can't affect the long-term behavior because your instruments aren't precise enough. And yeah, you can use bombs to push the weather off, but how precise is your bomb going to be?
Oh, yeah, exactly.
Your bomb would have to be precise enough to do, you know, things one way or another.
It also strikes me that if you had, let's say, some kind of thing out in space, right, that it has the Schrodinger's box type thing that sends out one part that either, like, you know, that counts the amount of radioactive decay and has a 50% of sending out like an atom. It strikes me that if we follow the multiple world interpretation of physics, that, like, you know, just that tiny little difference, that one atom between these two universes, ignoring even quantum fluctuations, that you would see different weather patterns no matter how small the difference was between the two, which right. is why he talks about, obviously, the butterfly wings.
Butterfly wings, yes. The idea of a seagull flapping its wings in one part of the world can eventually change the weather in another part of the world. 10 years later, in 1972, he was going to give a presentation on this, and it was actually the person who was putting the program together for the conference who came up with the butterfly instead of the seagull. But what we call it today is the butterfly effect. The idea that, yes, the butterfly flapping its wings in Brazil can eventually cause a tornado in Texas. And Lorenz himself was kind of skeptical about this and pointed out that, you know, if one butterfly flapping its wings can cause a tornado, then another butterfly flapping its wings can stop a tornado. And what about all the other butterflies and the seagulls and the mosquitoes and, you know, everything else? So he was not such a big fan of the butterfly effect. He was a bit too down to earth for that. But it did catch on.
I like how his range of down to earth is a butterfly. The butterfly is far too small. Seagull, that's fine.
Yes. So yeah, but the butterfly effect has been very popular, and there's I never saw the original Jurassic Park, but there's a scene in the original Jurassic Park where Jeff Goldblum is explaining the butterfly effect, and he does a better job than most. A lot of people don't quite get what the butterfly effect means, but if you want to know, I guess you need to watch the original Jurassic Park then.
Or we could roll that clip.
Still not clear on chaos.
It simply deals with predictability in complex systems. The shorthand is the butterfly effect. A butterfly can flap its wings in Peking, and in Central Park you get rain instead of sunshine.
Why?
Robert Black's book series covers seven mathematicians over six books spanning four centuries of mathematics and covers mathematicians from all walks of life. This book is geared towards expanding children's education through bringing mathematicians to life through stories. I'm Sophia, and this has been Breaking Math. With me, I had on Robert Black. Let me ask you, where can people access these books?
My books are available through the Royal Fireworks Press website, rfwp.com. And can also find my earlier books there. And I just hope that people looking for ways to understand math better and to see it as we've been talking about, a human activity, something that regular people do for regular reasons. It's a good opportunity if they want to know more about that and they want to think about how everybody else is, they might think, well, I'm a regular person and I've got regular reasons. And wouldn't it be nice if I could do math too? If math has always seemed kind of alien or foreign to them, then maybe reading how other people came to approach it will help them as well.
Awesome. So there we go.